You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. I'm Rebecca Zerman. On the second half of our show, we will speak with Gina Dickey with Arkansas Early Childhood Association about the importance of early childhood education and the impact of early childhood workforce in Arkansas. And now, a bill is being discussed by the General Assembly that could help increase the quality of early education in the state. But first, we will discuss recent developments in the state's Medicaid work reporting requirements, which a federal judge recently ruled as invalid, but not before 18,000 Arkansans lost their health care coverage. We will talk about what the work requirements were, how they impact Arkansans, and what happens next following the judge's ruling. We are joined by Loretta Alexander, Healthcare Policy Director at Arkansas Advocates, and Kevin DeLieben, a attorney at Legal Aid of Arkansas. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And just so our listeners know, since Kevin's calling in from out of town, you won't be able to call in during this segment of the show, but Kevin will give you his contact information. So if you have questions for Legal Aid about the work reporting requirements, you'll be able to call him. So let's get started. What were the work reporting requirements for Medicaid?
Work requirements were specific to people who received Arkansas Works Medicaid coverage. It covered people between the ages of 19 and 49. It still does cover, it covers people 19 to 64, but the requirements covered people aged 19 to 49. They were required to report 80 hours per month of working or work-related activities, including volunteering, job training, job seeking, or qualified health education classes. However, there were various exemptions with different reporting requirements. If a person was unable to take care of themselves or taking care of someone else in a drug or alcohol treatment facility, they were required to report every 2 months. If they were in school, in vocational training full-time, receiving unemployment benefits, they were required to report every 6 months. And then there was another set of reporting requirements for that applied to people that were on T or SNAP. They were automatically exempt because the state was gaining information on them from T and SNAP. And if they had a child in the household between the under age 19, they were exempt from reporting. Thank you.
So,
I guess the only thing I would add to that is that the state had an online-only reporting system for basically all of 2018. So even if somebody was exempt or was meeting the requirements and was working or something else, they had to go online through a very, very difficult to navigate system to try to report the exemption. So, you know, of the many people who were terminated, it's not that all of those people who were terminated, 18,000, were not working. Many of them were working or had an exemption, but simply weren't able to, you know, navigate the state's very difficult reporting system.
And I've seen that website that it's not mobile friendly. It's really tiny on your screen, and it doesn't even look like it's for reporting work requirements or signing up for benefits. To me, at least, it looks like it's trying to steal my personal information to sell it online.
Yeah, well, and if you manage to figure out where to click, you know, in those very difficult to navigate screens, that's still no guarantee that you'll be able to sign in. You had to have a reference number, which oftentimes was buried on one of many letters you may or may not have received from DHS. Some of those reference numbers didn't work, and you had to call in and get replacement reference numbers. Some of those replacement numbers didn't work. So there was a whole host of hoops you had to jump through just to get onto the website to report. And once you did that, it also wasn't particularly easy. So we have had many clients who had to actually get help from us or somebody else who kind of is a professional insurance person or a professional reporter just to be able to comply with that reporting requirement.
And a lot of people didn't even see the letters come in that they were supposed to start reporting their work. Is that correct?
That is correct. People received the letters. The requirement was started on June 1st. Some people said that they didn't they didn't know what it meant when they received it. Others said that they simply did not receive it. You know, and certainly if people were in transition, had moved from one place to the other. And also if people were in the process of moving and changing their address, if DHS actually received anything in return mail, they automatically closed those cases without forwarding mail to anyone or looking for that person. So there were various reasons that people did not get those letters.
And this was rolled out pretty quickly. I mean, what was the intent of this program, and why was it rolled out so quickly?
Well, the state had been waiting for approval from the federal government for many, many months. There wasn't a really definite time frame on which approval was to come. Now, we don't know what those back-end communications were, so maybe the state had better ideas than the general public did. And then once approval came in March of 2018, the state seemed intent on just putting them into effect as soon as possible. And so they set the start date of June 1st, which meant there wasn't much ramp-up time for any of it. In terms of your question about the intent, Rebecca, it's, you know, far be it from me to presume the mind of any of the decision makers here, but I will say that advocates throughout the process of considering these work requirements all warned, hey, people are going to lose coverage. It's not going to work for people. We know this from other contexts and other places where it's happened, and the state still went ahead with that. And so when you know something's going to result in coverage loss and people getting kicked off, and you know that's going to be a widespread problem, and you still go forward, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that maybe what the intended result was is people losing coverage.
Yes, Kevin, I totally agree with you there. We don't know what the intent was, but we certainly know what the results were. And not only were there advocacy organizations warning of the unintended consequences, there were also organizations like the Hospital Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics, and a lot of provider organizations were also warning of the consequences of kicking people off of Medicaid because of their work requirements, reporting work requirements.
So last week, a federal judge said that the work reporting requirements weren't valid. They couldn't be enforced anymore. Kevin, you worked on that case. Can you talk about what that ruling actually said?
Yeah, sure. So the big thing to know is that there's no place in all of Medicaid law that allows for work requirements. They're not mentioned anywhere. And that's very different from like the SNAP program, or which is food stamps, or the TANF program, where the statute passed by Congress says something about work required. Nowhere in Medicaid. So what the federal and state governments were trying to do is run these through these new work requirements, which is a radical transformation of Medicaid, through a very narrow section of authority that allows the federal government to grant states kind of a waiver, a deviation from the norm in cases where there are experimental projects that are meant to further the main purpose of the Medicaid Act, which is to furnish medical assistance. And so they were basically trying to stuff an elephant in a mouse hole. And so what the judge said is because the federal government didn't even consider the threat of coverage loss of these work requirements, there's no way that the approval was rational. In other words, if the main objective of Medicaid is to furnish medical assistance, how does taking away medical assistance help furnish medical assistance? It was kind of that paradox. And that's what the judge really seized on in ruling as he did.
And the same day, he also ruled about a similar work requirement in Kentucky. Was that part of the same ruling, or those two separate rulings?
They're two separate rulings. So Arkansas's ruling was sort of where Kentucky was last year, and the judge threw out Kentucky's work requirements last year, and then the federal government in Kentucky went back for a round two, and the judge was ruling on round two of Kentucky. But what the judge's ruling in Kentucky said or showed is that this isn't just a simple technicality that the state would easily be able to fix or that the federal government would be able to easily fix. It was something kind of more fundamental than that. So it wasn't going to be just a little technicality where the judge would think that it would be okay to continue the work requirements while the federal government in Arkansas figure out what was going to, you know, what was going to happen next.
And yes, 18,000 people lost their health insurance in less than a year, but these people had very personal stories about how this impacted them, and some in really deeply adverse ways. Can you talk about some of the clients that were part of this case and the stories of what they experienced, Kevin?
Yeah, sure. So the judge led off with the story of Adrian McGonigal, who's a client of ours, who was also profiled on the PBS NewsHour in a really in-depth piece back in November. Adrian had been working at the best job that he'd had in years, if not ever, at a poultry plant. He had COPD. He'd always had weak lungs, had asthma as a child, and that translated into adult COPD. He wasn't a smoker at all. He just had this condition. As long as he had his meds, he was able to work. He learned about the work requirements, thought he reported correctly 1 month. He thought that's all he had to do. So he goes to the pharmacy in October to pick up his COPD meds, and the pharmacist tells him that it'll be $800, $900. And this is the first time that Adrian learned that he had been terminated from coverage. And, of course, he didn't have that kind of money, ran out of his meds, ended up in the ER several times in the span of a few weeks, 3-4 weeks. He was in the ER, I think, 3 or 4 times. His job was trying to work with him, but they ultimately had to say, well, you know, he couldn't show up for work and had to let him go. After that, Adrian ended up couch surfing, being functionally homeless, moving between relatives. It was several months before he got the insurance back that would cover all his meds. And, you know, even now, basically, he's been limited to looking for work in the fast food sector, earning several dollars per hour less than he was earning before. So that's just an example of the way that Medicaid itself is a work support. You have health insurance, you're able to get the treatments and medicines that you need to be able to maintain your health so that you can work sustainably. And when you take people's coverage away, it undermines their ability to work. And unfortunately, Adrian had to suffer all this, still isn't back on his feet, isn't going to be back to where he was before for a long time. That kind of illustrates what's happened to many people.
Loretta, have you heard similar stories?
I have. There's actually the story of Russell Cook, who was 26 years old, living in Little Rock and homeless. And while he spent time working as a landscaper, he wasn't presently employed when the lawsuit was filed. And the Medicaid program had previously given him at least access to health care, although he wasn't working. And he had a torn Achilles tendon and several dental problems. He doesn't believe that he'll be able to keep up with making those reported requirements because he's homeless and he doesn't have steady internet access and was expecting to lose his coverage. And, you know, these are just some of the examples. There were at least 10 people that were involved in the actual lawsuit. And of those 10, I mean, obviously there were another over 18,000 that lost their coverage for various reasons.
And Kevin, you mentioned earlier, it sounds like this ruling on the Medicaid work requirements doesn't really impact other work reporting requirements like for SNAP.
That's absolutely right.
And so what? Oh, go on.
No, go ahead.
Oh, so I was just going to say, so what happens next? The state has said that they plan on appealing this ruling. So what are the next steps?
So the state itself isn't going to be able to appeal. It would be the federal government that decides whether or not to appeal. And the governor has said that he's had conversations with the federal government urging the federal government to appeal. So the ball is really in their court. As of now, an appeal has not been filed. But they'll have, you know, they'll have still ample time to do that.
And so for the people who have lost their health insurance already, is there any way that they, those 18,000, can they get it back? Was there an enrollment period and now it's over? What can they do?
Well, those people that lost their benefits last year, they were eligible to reapply starting January 1st of this year. However, most of them did not. In fact, as of February, there were less than 3,000 people that had actually reapplied of those that lost their coverage last year. They are eligible to go to their local county office and complete the application process again. I looked at information directly from the state attorney general's office, and she said that there's nothing that says that DHS has to automatically re-enroll those people, so it doesn't appear that the state is going to automatically re-enroll them. It looks like they will have to go and start from scratch all over again, re-enrolling to get that coverage.
And if anybody has any problems with that process of signing back up for coverage, they're welcome to call Legal Aid of Arkansas for help if they, you know, if DHS doesn't act on their application quickly, or if DHS is asking for information or denies them and the person thinks that's wrong, they're welcome to call Legal Aid. And our number is 1-800-967-9224.
Unfortunately, those people that had not complied for the last 2 months, for the last 3 months now, January, February, and March, they will not be cut off based on the ruling from last week. So they will continue their coverage, unlike those people that got cut off last fall.
And so no one right now who has Medicaid needs to report that they're working?
That's correct.
Right.
So if things change, if the federal court, or I guess it would go to the Supreme Court next, if the federal government did appeal this ruling, how can people stay up to date with what's going on in that system?
Yeah, I think, you know, Loretta and I work very closely together, and we try to put out good information to the public to let folks know what the latest is. So I'd encourage everybody to follow Arkansas Advocates and follow Legal Aid of Arkansas on Facebook if you can. You know, we know a lot of people don't have access to the internet, but sometimes friends and family do, and check our pages for latest information. If people want to sign up and kind of get other information, sometimes I send out a little newsletter. Everybody's welcome to contact me that way. The media has been pretty good about reporting things. And one thing that we're also really going to emphasize is amongst all the service providers, so pharmacies, health centers, hospitals, homeless service providers, food banks, and other places, we're going to try to get the word out that everybody can reapply and let everybody know what the latest developments are.
And Kevin, do you want to talk about some of the other issues that you're working on related to healthcare in Arkansas and some other cases you're trying to make sure that people are able to keep their coverage in different programs?
Sure. Well, one thing is with Arkansas Works itself, we've seen a lot of our clients who've been terminated because of paperwork requirements. So they're sent a letter and they're given 10 days to respond to it. Oftentimes they don't get it till day 5 or 6. They may get the information in by day 10, and DHS just doesn't process it in time, and people are getting terminated. So if you're getting terminated from Arkansas Works for other reasons, paperwork, lack of income verification, they say that you didn't return some piece of mail, and DHS is giving you any problems about that, again, you're welcome to call Legal Aid. The other big issue we're working on is with the AR Choices program. This is a Medicaid program that pays for caregiving services that allows somebody who is elderly or who has a disability to remain in their home instead of in a nursing home. And of course, that's really a lot better for somebody's dignity and overall happiness. And it's also better for the state's bottom line because it's much cheaper. The state in 2016 switched to an algorithm-based assessment system, so kind of an automated computer-based assessment system that was deciding how many hours that people would get. We ended up getting that algorithm-based assessment system kicked out. It was dropped by the state, but now the state has adopted a new and different kind of algorithm-based assessment system, and we are starting to see people call us who are getting terminated entirely from the program or getting told that they have to go into nursing homes because their needs are so severe, or people who are getting their hours reduced to the point where they might not be able to maintain life independently in the community and would have to go into the nursing home. And so that's the AR Choices program. And if anybody's being affected by that, they're also welcome to call Legal Aid of Arkansas or our sister organization, the Center for Arkansas Legal Services.
Any final thoughts for our listeners? This is a lot of information, and unfortunately it did impact so many people. So Kevin will give his number again in just a second, but if you did lose your health insurance because of the work reporting requirements, go to your local DHS office, call Legal Aid if you need help, because you can get your insurance back and there's no reason that you should be without your insurance.
I agree with you, Rebecca. Yeah, people just need to go back in and get their insurance, sign up again. We don't know how long it may take them to get approved, so the more quickly they get into the DHS office, the more quickly they will start the process to getting their coverage. One thing that we didn't say is that now when people do re-enroll, they will have the 3 months of retroactive coverage, which they were not allowed to have during the work reporting requirements. So previously, prior to the work requirements, people could go back, Medicaid would cover them back 3 months. So that is now in place again.
And then the other thing I'd want all listeners to know is that Arkansas Advocates, Legal Aid of Arkansas, the Urban League, and Philander Smith Social Justice Institute, we're all co-sponsoring a forum about the work requirements on April 16th. That's Tuesday, April 16th at 6 p.m. at the Willie Hinton Center. And what we're going to do is, even though the work requirements are gone, we're going to let everybody know what the next steps are. We're going to go into depth on what happened and why, so that people understand fully why people got kicked off, how the work requirements were working, and what lessons might be learned from that. So everybody's welcome. Children are welcome to come. Food is going to be served. And Legal Aid will also be present on site for anybody who was kicked off insurance or is having insurance problems with Medicaid. You can talk with one of us so that we can see if there's something that we can do for you. So again, that's April 16th, a Tuesday night at the Willie Hinton Center at 6 p.m.
And what's your number again, Kevin?
Well, 1-800-967-9224. And we have a special Medicaid line. So when you dial that, if you press 4, it'll go right to either me or one of my colleagues. And if we can't answer right then, we'll get back to you within a day.
Well, thank you both for joining us today and talking about this important issue. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about early childhood education and the early childhood workforce. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us, Rebecca.
Thank you for having us.
This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas.
Hi, this is Alanis Morissette, and you're listening to KABF 88.3 in Little Rock, the voice of the people.
And we are back with Gina Dickey with the Arkansas Early Childhood Association to discuss early childhood education in Arkansas and the early childhood workforce. Thank you for joining us, Gina.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So let's just get started about what is early childhood education. What's the average day for a baby or toddler when they go to school?
Yeah, so the official definition of early childhood from a academic standpoint is that period of time in a child life from 0 to age 8. And that really is, so people don't always think about the kindergartners, first and second graders being part of our group, but we know that children learn differently in that time. And one of the things that's really key is this hands-on physical activity. You learn with all your senses. And then after third grade, grade level reading campaign often says, you know, we learn to read till the third grade, and after third grade, we are reading to learn. So there's some things that are going on differently with children. So babies should have that same sort of opportunity to experience the world. I say people that children come as little scientists, and that it's the grown-up's responsibility really to make a place where you can roam freely and be told no as little as possible. So, you know, providing that safe and healthy environment for them and giving them lots of things to explore. So in a childcare program, one of the things you'd want to see is a lot of interaction with the adults and the children, a lot of verbal skills, talking to the baby. The same thing goes with any listener who's a parent or a grandparent of little kids. Even before they can talk, that's when we're building those neural pathways for speech. Mm-hmm. So lots of conversation.
On a different show that we did, a doctor was saying that even just narrating what you're doing, if you're washing dishes or if you're going grocery shopping, just to help the babies build those neural pathways.
Yeah, you feel a little crazy because you're kind of talking to yourself because you're talking to the baby and the baby's not talking back to you. Mm-hmm. I have had the delightful privilege of having a grandchild. She turned 8 months yesterday. So I've been teasing my colleagues. I have this renewed interest in the quality of infant and toddler care in my state. But I was babysitting Gwyneth recently. She was in the car longer than she wanted to be. We had nowhere to be. We stopped at Walmart just because, and we took a field trip. And so we spent about 45 minutes in the produce section talking about all the fruits and vegetables, right? And not because I needed fruits and vegetables, but was like, that's a field trip for a baby, is going to the produce section.
Better than teaching her about the candy aisle.
That's right. We stayed away from the candy aisle.
And if you have any questions, we're talking about early childhood education, the early childhood workforce, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And it seems like there's a lot of discussion nowadays about early childhood education, but it seems fairly recent that there's so much focus on it. Is the brain science fairly new about early childhood?
So it's not. It's probably hit mainstream. I remember an article actually in 1999. Time covered it as the cover story, and so did Newsweek in the same year. And so there's all this information because we could finally see a baby's brain, right? We could have that neuroscience allowed us to look. I think the tricky part about staying consistent with people having that information is the same thing that makes it tricky about providing parent education. In 1999, the people that are parents now were children, right? Mm-hmm. So when they heard the information, it had no relevance to them. And I think that's oftentimes the barrier with getting information to people about this sort of thing that's only important to me when it's relevant to me. And so that just keeps turning over. You know, who becomes the new parent is very interested in that. But in, you know, 10 years ago, they weren't interested in that. So I think that makes it tricky.
And 80% of a child's brain is developed by the age of 3. So those years are so critical.
Yeah, 0 to 5, you see a lot of interaction going on. The neurosynapses that form, that scientists now know is 1 million a minute. And so that's happening at its peak around 6 months all the way through age 3. And then we know after that, we start pruning back things we don't use. So even before children can read, they're laying that foundation. Before they can talk, they're laying that foundation. And that's still not common knowledge.
And so even if your baby and toddler aren't really talking to you too much, talk to them because they're listening and they're absorbing that information.
They are. And I appreciate the example you gave. It's not a special conversation. It's about just whatever we're doing. Because if you remember, everything's new to a baby. You do not have to entertain them. I bought some things for Gwyneth last week to play toys, but the toys were scrubbers for the pots and pans, right? The texture, the color. Toys are usually for grown-ups, a lot of flashy things with batteries.
So that's important information to save you money. Just buy some cheap sponges and your baby will love it.
So. Exactly. And what else did I find? A spatula. And I think the favorite thing that day was a spatula. Yeah, stuff in your cabinet. Long as it's safe, you know, no rough edges, you're good to go.
Don't give in to consumerism.
That's
right. Save some money.
Exactly.
So it's not just parents and educators that are talking about early childhood education. It seems also, and maybe it's because when you were talking about this however long ago, I was a baby, but it seems like businesses and the military and other similar groups are also seeing the value of early childhood education for what they do.
Yeah, the military and business is a good example. There's probably been some movement around that for probably since the brain research came out. There was kind of a surgence of that. I think locally we've got some good examples. One of my favorite examples is some conversations that are going around in Independence County and Batesville area. And the Chamber of Commerce didn't take a lot of credit for coming to that conclusion. They basically started to talk about workforce readiness. They were talking to the two-year college there, the two-year college. It just went down the line until they were settled on, really, it all started in early childhood. So that connecting the dots, that understanding that our cognitive development, some of our social soft skills, like working well with others, started long before we got to kindergarten. And the brain research validates that. So I think businesses gotten engaged in that because they understand it's an investment in a future employee. The other positive thing about early childhood as an investment is it does affect the employee engagement for the current workforce, but it also is then that brain development for your future workforce. So it's kind of you get a twofer for your investments in early childhood.
And again, we're talking about early childhood education and the early childhood workforce. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And it is kind of crazy to think that how I learned to handle my emotions, my anger, and all of that when I was very young is similar to how I handle them now.
Mm-hmm. I think for any of the audience that's of my age, right, where I've seen a child at 3 and now see them at 23. When you're talking to that person, you can see them at 3. Like that, we know some of those personality traits really begin to form and some of those qualities and characteristics before I get to kindergarten. And for those of us who've worked with young children or have had them or known them and see them now as adults, you can see that very clearly.
And so how many early childhood centers, about if you had a ballpark, are in Arkansas, and about how many kids are served by them?
Gosh, I should know the answer to that question, Rebecca.
It's okay.
And
a lot.
Yes, I'm so sorry,
because no, okay.
I'm like, it just left my mind, that number. I don't know. I'll come back to that when it comes to me. I'll blurt it out.
But the main point of that question was to what you were talking about before, that this is really critical for the workforce right now, making sure people can go to work because they have a safe place to put their child, where their child's also being able to get those opportunities to develop their brain.
Yeah, the number I do know off the top of my head right now is that, just based on census data over the years, and it really hadn't changed, is that 58% of families with children under five, so not yet in kindergarten, have both parents working outside the home or are single parents who are working outside the home. So we know there's a more than half of the families in Arkansas with young children need someone else to help watch their kids while they're at work in school. So it is a lot of children. And we don't always have that many slots available in some of our communities that there is a need for, especially for infants and toddlers.
And so it is, we've established it's really critical, but at the same time, the early childhood workforce has long struggled with issues around pay. Can you talk a bit about that, the causes of that? And UMAS did a recent study with early childhood teachers, but also the directors too. And even the directors themselves have issues around pay.
Yeah. I think for a lot of parents that might be listening, that might seem a little surprising because childcare could be the largest expense I have in my family. If I have two children, it is likely to be more than my mortgage and my rent. So when I walk into a center and I'm counting 15 kids and I know what I'm paying for tuition, it may feel like people are making plenty of money. But the largest expense for childcare is the personnel cost. And that can go somewhere between 65 to 90% of their whole budget. It's an expensive business as far as it's personnel heavy. And it's different than other businesses because I mandated, for good reason, to have a certain number of grown-ups per children, so the ratio. And so if I'm caring for very young children, infants and toddlers, the ideal ratio for an infant is four babies for one adult. So that's only four tuitions paying for that salary. And so typically that does not break even because there are additional costs like food and rent and those kind of things. So childcare workers themselves have been the largest subsidizer, I guess, of early education through its inception. Like based on us taking lower wages so that parents can afford it. So we've been subsidizing the system as a workforce. And I do think some of that has to do with that we're about 99.9% women. So with this pay inequity, which was brought to everyone's attention yesterday, as far as the timing on gender equity for pay, being predominantly female workforce also plays into the low wages.
And one worker for four babies, that's a lot of babies to be caring for and educating. So it's not an easy job.
It's the hardest job I know. And what I tell, we actually, our minimum licensing standards allows five babies for one worker. And that's new. Up until this year, we were one of only two states in the country that allowed six babies for one worker. Which really is, we know, not to be ideal. The National Association of Education for Young Children has set best practice for ratios, and so has the American Association of Pediatrics. And that minimum, and parents should know, are consumers of childcare, that minimum licensing requirements are minimum, and that they're really to protect children's health and safety. Best practice is typically different. So that's a good example of 5-to-1 is allowed in the state, but what would be optimal from a best practice standpoint would be 3 or 4, but then the costs go up even more. And so a lot of times our childcare system works within a free market, right? It's parent-driven, parent-supported, but it doesn't necessarily work within that because of the personnel. Just like K-12, right, has external support from a broader state support, because parents couldn't afford to send their children to private school. So early education really is more like K-12, but that's not how we pay for it.
So the centers could increase their costs to cover higher educator pay, but it would price out a lot of parents.
It'd be on the backs of families. And I can't, it's hard to explain my colleagues in the field. My husband and I just had this conversation yesterday. It's practically missionary work. Like, it's, if you can call yourself for profit, a profit margin for most for profit centers is 4%. Most people wouldn't go into business for less than 30% profit margin. And I tease my colleagues because a 4% profit margin really isn't a profit. I said, that just means you can fix the air conditioner when it breaks. So people really do this out of a mission to serve their community and a love for children. And they really do try to balance providing the best possible care that they can for what families, it doesn't put too much burden on financially for a family. That they struggle with that, my childcare owners, even as they collect tuition. They know about families who have financial difficulties and they struggle with collecting the fee even when they provide the service because they become kind of an extension of their family.
And so what did the UMAS studies find in relation to how this is actually impacting the early childhood workers?
Both studies, they're very exciting to us.
And depressing.
I was going to say depressing in that it finally put a number to things we kind of knew, but only anecdotally. But exciting to have finally a number, like that we didn't just tell our story. We had some data for that. And so that came about, if I may, kind of, I think the nature in which it came about is important. Kellogg Foundation, the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, and the Arkansas Community Foundation had pooled some money together for two place-based projects in Arkansas. We were in Marvel and we were in Prescott to really say, could you improve early childhood education at a community level if you had this multi-agency approach to that and included the whole community? And it was a three-year project, and a lot of great things happened. And colleagues from Arkansas State University Childhood Services were the team that worked directly with the providers, and they provided some amazing training. Some national experts came in. The curriculum was purchased for locations, all the things that they identified as a need for them to improve the quality of care. But through those 3 years, each time these teachers were trained and had this new information, they would leave the field because they could make more money working at the Sonic, that was a real example, than they could in childcare. So we poured everything but the kitchen sink into this project to move the needle, and it did, but not to the degree it should have in the 3 years and what we had anticipated. So that was sort of sparked this interest in then funding this workforce data, because we said if we don't get a handle on that, we're not going to be able to improve quality of care across the state. So Kellogg paid for one of the studies. We're so formal in early education, we refer to them as the blue one and the green one. So the blue one was done with teachers. So they were surveyed electronically, there were focus groups done, and so there was a lot of conversations with the field itself, over 1,200 participants in the survey. And the other one was funded through the Division of Child Care and Early Childhood Education with administrators, the green one, and that got really to some statistical information about who is in our field, demographic information. Mm-hmm. So they make a nice complement. What we learned in those in the course of that conversation was that that more than 58% of our workforce had trouble paying for their basic needs in the last year, and basic needs being rent, transportation, basic needs. Mm-hmm. In the wisdom of UAMS's team that put the survey together, they went further into getting more clarification about what level of struggle or challenge with that. So they zeroed in on food insecurity, being specifically about meeting a basic need, mm-hmm. and found out that 40% of our workforce ran out of food, cut meals, or skipped meals in the last year because of lack of resources. If they were in preschool, if they were infant toddler teacher, they were 50% food insecure. So we tend to have a little more academic focus in our 3 and 4 year programs for preschool. So often put the more qualified teacher in that classroom, the least qualified teacher when the brain is developing the most in the infant room, and then we pay accordingly, or don't have support through a state funded system to help subsidize the teacher's salary in the infant toddler room.
So for our listeners who have children in childcare, there's a 50-50 shot that your teacher that's with your little one goes hungry sometimes.
Yeah. I talked to a director in Saline County a couple of weeks ago. And when we receive new federal funds for child care vouchers for families that are making 150% of poverty or below, every teacher in her program that had a child qualified for the vouchers. So we often are serving families with the personnel that qualify for the same services.
And if you have a question about early childhood education, the early childhood workforce, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And this, you know, financial issues doesn't just affect, you know, in terms of your ability to pay your bills, it has a impact emotionally as well. And that study also talked about depression rates for teachers too, didn't it?
It did. There were three questions within the survey that were markers for as part of a formal questionnaire that were included in that to see if a person might have a risk of depression. And out of 35% of early childhood teachers screen positive for depression risk. And when it's about, that's a substantial number compared to the national average. I think if I remember correctly, the national average is 5%. So, you know, if we just took 100 people off the street, 5% of us might, screen positive for depression. This is 1 in 3. In a child care center. And I think something that's really important, and Dr. McKelvey, who was the lead researcher on this project, that when she does this presentation says she's definitive about these numbers because one of the questions that was asked of people responding to the survey was the quality of the location they worked in. Mm-hmm. And we defined the quality. Arkansas has a quality rating improvement system referred to as Better Beginnings. And so if a program is in level 3, we consider that high quality. If it's an ABC program, Arkansas Better Chance that receives state funding, it's a high quality program because of the additional standards that are on those programs. And Head Start as well has additional standards beyond minimum licensing. So when respondents worked in a level 3 program, Head Start or ABC, they were considered in a high quality program. We had a disproportionate number of returns from high quality programs. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that they're paying better because of them having additional resources than a lower quality program. So if our numbers are this high in high quality programs, we would certainly feel comfortable saying they're probably higher in the field altogether.
And what's the recruitment and retention rates for early childhood centers because of this? You said that you've heard someone leaving the field to go work at a fast food restaurant. I spoke with an early childhood educator in a smaller town. She was the director. She went to the Hobby Lobby and saw how much the Hobby Lobby was paying. And she said there's no way she could pay her teachers that amount. She didn't even make that amount.
Yeah. That varies a lot. So programs that have additional support like Head Start and ABC, they have a lower ratio of turnover. On average, nationally, the number still hovers around 100%. So annually. So if I've got 10 teachers, then at the end of the year, I may not have 10 different teachers, but I've had one slot maybe turnover a couple of times. In my personal experience, we had the highest turnover in the toddler room. Toddlers are pretty challenging people. They're just keeping them off the shelves is kind of its own task, and we're trying to teach them something. So it can be really kind of a challenging position. And oftentimes after-school programs have a higher turnover because we often attract part-time staff that has a full-time school schedule that changes by the semester and things. So a lot of variables play into that, but easily can be 100% in a program.
This is astounding.
It's sad.
So, I mean, it's a really complicated situation because, again, you don't want to price out parents from being able to put their children in the child care and preschool centers. So what are some possible ways that you think we could solve this? Because obviously it's a huge problem. And I think for parents, even if they are able to get their children in those slots, they should be concerned about the turnover rate, about the what the their children's teachers are going through, and then just the fact that it makes it difficult to recruit the, you know, people with bachelor's degrees and things like that to go in the field, which, again, when 80% of this core brain development happens in such an early age, you want the best and brightest to go to the child care centers to teach.
Yeah. I think short term, as a consumer, as someone looking for childcare for my child, I just really need to look for places that are warm and responsive to my kids, right? Like there's some, well, you can look at a level 3 program and know what that means, but asking a director what her turnover rate is and asking how she supports her staff, right? Those getting involved in what seems like maybe not your business, but the most important component of any classroom is the grown-ups in it. Right. So thinking to ask the question about turnover. I assisted my son in looking for infant care. And that was one of the conversations we had about how long the staff had been in place and those kind of things. So I think being involved in that, communicating with your team every day, like really getting to know each other and helping each other out. I think you're one of the things that in early education, because we pay someone to do something we kind of wish we were doing ourselves, it kind of starts out with a strained relationship, because I didn't necessarily want to leave my baby all day to go to work, but I need to go to work. Mm-hmm. And so, but learning to work as a partner with that person really does matter to both people. Right, where the teacher feels appreciated for the work she's doing and they get to know each other in support of and the baby being the focus. Long term, we need some big policy changes. Every other industrialized country has early education is built into its continuum of public education. And I think we really need to start talking about that out loud. Stephanie Kuntz is a sociologist who wrote a book years and years ago, and one of the recommendations she made was to not to pay more for education, but to back into it and pay more to start paying for early education and start sending kids off to college at 16. Like if we ditched junior and senior year, and you could talk to most junior and seniors about what they think they learned those 2 years, it probably doesn't seem like a bad idea. And use that money for those 2 years for earlier, not later. Like just thinking out of the box on what that would look like and how we would move forward.
And don't a lot of countries do that, like Canada and countries in Europe?
Every industrialized nation but us helps pay for early education.
Well, but I mean sending people to college.
Oh, early to college. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And we know that about physiological development. Like we have 16-year-olds now who are more mature than they've ever been in our human history. Like they just have more information. They have access to things. Physiologically, they're more mature. You know, have some transition for that and send them off to big school, trade, you know, those kind of things. Back, if you think about one of the things about Stephanie's book is that 200 years ago, I would have sent my 14-year-old to learn to be a blacksmith because that's, and it's still kind of a good idea. Like people are ready to do more than sometimes we give them an opportunity as young adults. So, I mean, that's one kind of big idea. Some things we're looking at here in Arkansas. There's been actually 38 either states or regions or cities who have done some kind of compensation strategy for workforce, understanding mm-hmm. that they could supplement it, right, with this system. So a tax credit, like in Louisiana, that's been in place for 11 years. They reward a person for receiving higher education. That's not a requirement, but we know is a correlation between the quality of care mm-hmm. and subsidizing them through that tax incentive. At the same time, Arkansas is looking at initiating a scholarship program for early childhood practitioners who are interested in going back to school, but they got to come together because right now I can go back and get my AA. But if my program can't pay me anymore, what was sort of the point of that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I learn more, and I appreciate that someone would want to do that, but it doesn't financially doesn't make sense to them as a family. So I think we've really got to look for some near future things to do around those kind of things. And then looking at how does our early childhood workforce potentially fit into the K-12 teacher pipeline? We have a teacher shortage in K-12. We have groups of people in all over the state who understand child development, work with families every day. Might we, you know, blend those two workforces together to improve, you know, public education system with a continuum starting in early childhood?
And I think that's a wonderful point that, you know, these two systems have been seen very differently in the past, and one's just considered babysitting, like you're just sending your baby to childcare and they watch cartoons all day and sit in their crib. But that's not what's happening. These babies are learning, these toddlers are learning, and that learning is going to impact them not just in K through 12, but into adulthood. Again, going back to your point about that social emotional learning and how good of an employee they're going to end up being.
Yeah, yeah. And Harvard Center for Developing Child has great information for any listener who'd like to delve into more information on the brain research. They've got great videos and one-pagers. And when they've got a couple of charts talking about the opportunity for learning, really, you know, the maximum opportunity with the brain capacity versus as I get older, the capacity diminishes. If you look at that, clearly, the most important teachers on that spectrum are the infant teachers, not the college teacher, the infant teacher, not the high school teacher, although physics in high school is a great thing. I'm not knocking my colleagues in older grades, but we don't support the systems accordingly. Like, the math is really simple. If this is the capacity for children, then we should put more money into that opportunity and then think about how we spread that out over time. And we've not done that. We still have a system that we set up 200 years ago when children stayed home on the farm with their family. And we don't do that anymore, but we've not rethought the system.
We do take a week off during duck and deer season in some parts of the state.
Yes, though. We do. Yes, we do. I grew up with that holiday. Yes, deer season holiday.
So we have about a minute and a half left. Do you have any final thoughts about this issue?
I hope you'll hear more about it in the next few years. I think there's some national conversation to talk about the workforce. My colleagues are not necessarily good at speaking out on their own behalf, but we're starting to have that conversation about the importance of their work, the importance of the first 5 years, and then the importance of their work. And that it should be paid for accordingly. So I'm hoping this is the beginning of more conversations about that.
And so thank you so much for joining us today, Gina, and talking about this. And for our listeners, if you have a child in early childhood education, daycare or preschool, thank them because they've got a tough job and aren't making very much. And you can go to our website, aradvocates.org, and find out more information about this. And you can search for the Arkansas Early Childhood Association and get their take on the issue, too. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next month. And thankfully, the session will be over by then. So thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you next month.
You're listening to KABF 88.3, Little Rock, Arkansas, the voice of the people.
Today on Wings.
Some very important information about what we fiercely believe in and what we have to be doing in order to realize that vision.
There's a river of birds in my grave. A nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The United Nations Commission on the Status of Women meets yearly in New York. NGOs, that is, non-governmental organizations, also gather there.
So welcome, everyone, this morning. This is our Civil Society Consultation Day, brought to you by